Welcome, listeners. I'm Brad Hargraves, the host of the Thesis Driven Leader series, and really excited for this final episode of Thesis Driven Leader Series Season 1. And I want to thank everyone who's been listening in to all of our episodes, whether you started from the first one or are just joining us for the first time today. It's been a ton of fun. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from our subscribers, and we're really excited for this final episode. I'll be joined by today by Charles Marone, the author of Strong Towns. Charles refers to himself as a recovering engineer. In fact, he wrote a book called Confessions of a Recovering Engineer. But he's since really gotten into advocating for better policies for city and urban design. Policies that advocate and support the needs of individuals, of humans, as opposed to the needs of cars. He might be best known for coining the term strode, that is, a road that is sort of a street, sort of a road. It is somewhat designed for local use, accessing businesses, and somewhat designed for moving cars really quickly from place to place. So he thinks very deeply about how we design our cities, how do cities get designed in other places, and how can we do it better? And also, what role can technology play or not play in getting us to a better outcome in terms of how we design our cities and prioritize the needs of people and families in those cities? He's a great thinker on all these topics, so really excited to have this conversation today with Charles. Let's dive in. Chuck Marone, thank you so much for joining us on the Thesis Driven podcast and video series today. Thank you. Really excited to have you on the show.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. It's always nice to meet a new friend and be able to chat about fun stuff. So let's do it.
Amazing. So let's start talking a little bit about you and your background. So you began your post-military career as, you know, a civil engineer and a planner. Why pivot to advocacy?
Oh, that was not the plan, right? So I worked as a civil engineer, and then I went back to graduate school and got a planning degree. And when I was there, I wound up starting my own firm, my own practice. That was not something I intended to do. It was something that just happened. Cities that I had worked with called me and said, "Could you help out with this? And could you help out with that?" And pretty soon I was working almost full time as I was a full time student. I started hiring my classmates to help out with things. And by the time I graduated, I had my own engineering and planning firm kind of by accident. That went really well because that would have been 2000, 2001, 2002. And, you know, historically that was the big housing boom. And so there was tons of demand for the work that I was doing, tons of demand for our services. We were all over the state of Minnesota. In a couple of years, had five offices and over a dozen of us, and doing really well. In 2006, it all crashed. Before you could default on a house in 2008, before banks went bad, all that stuff, people stopped building, and they stopped building really in 2006. And our organization was on the very front end of that. So by the time we got to 2008, I had been having this dissonance within my own profession and with my own work, and to watch the meltdown happen in 2008, not that I foresaw it and knew what was going to happen, but I had been on the front lines enough to have been kind of the Chicken Little yelling, "The sky's falling, the sky's falling," long before the sky started to fall. And by the time we got to 2008, I was very frustrated with the world. And I started to write a blog. I just started to write about what I had seen, what I was experiencing. And that blog is what grew into Strong Towns. It really was nothing I set out to do, nothing I intended to have as a result. But it's where kind of events took me and my passions took me.
Yeah. So I want to get a little bit into the philosophy before we go into some of your writing and some of the work you've done. Obviously, you know, your blog has evolved into a number of books, including this one, Strong Towns. And I want to understand the movement a bit better, because as we discussed in the intro, it is really, I would say, critical of a lot of American design and development post-World War II. And one phrase that you used that I found really instructive is that the suburban model means that more people make things worse, not better. Would love for you to explain what that means.
Yeah. If we go back to the pre-Great Depression pattern of development, what you have is you have what I call, write about in the book, and what we talk about a lot is human habitat, very much in the way that bees build beehives, ants build anthills. If aliens were like watching us prior to the last 100 and some years, they would say, well, humans build this human habitat. They build cities, and they build it in a certain way. And we can see that way repeated over and over again around the world. Cities in, you know, Africa, cities in Asia, cities in Europe, they're going to have different building materials and different kind of tweaks to architecture, but a lot of what they build is going to be very, very similar. One of the defining characteristics of that development type is because it evolved out of thousands of years of trial and error, the pattern, the way you go about building stuff, does a great job of kind of maximizing resources and harmonizing many competing interests. I give the example of someone who's just building, like, I'm going to start a shop. I'm going to start a commercial business. The way you would do it in that pattern is you would build your building lined up with everybody else. You'd build it right up to the street. You'd create kind of a public realm with your building. You'd make the front of it symmetrical. You'd have the opening on the street. And all of those things you would do in your own selfish self-interest. But it also benefited the whole, in a sense. Again, that's that harmonizing of different things. When we look at the post-war pattern of development, it is not an evolved kind of understanding. It's not something that has come out of many, many thousands of years of trial and error. It's a theory that we just instituted everywhere all at once in a very short period of time. And the main impetus for it is to create transactions in our economy. How do we stay out of the Great Depression 2.0 when the war winds down? How do we grow as fast as we can? How do we, you know, build a middle class and keep this economy moving? And the sensitivities that we come out of that are sensitivities around how do we get the next transaction, as opposed to how do we maximize the value of what we're creating? How do we harmonize these many things? How do we make this all work over time? And so what you have is you have a system where, like, if I'm going to open a shop, the best thing in my selfish self-interest is actually rivalrous and competes with everybody else's selfish self-interest. It's not harmonizing. I would want a big sign. I would want, the most obnoxious sign I could have, because I would want my sign to stand out from everybody else's sign. I would want a big parking lot out in front of my building, a parking lot that would advertise to people driving by that there's plenty of room for them to stop here, even though that parking lot, costs a lot, has a lot of social costs, sheds a lot of water, uses a bunch of infrastructure without really creating any value from it. There's a whole bunch of negatives to that. I would have my building not be symmetrical. I would not really worry about the looks of my building as much as I would worry about just its functionality, the strip mall, the big box store. These are just like warehouses for like shoveling products out the door. And so all of a sudden I would be building things that were one life cycle, one transaction, didn't really build any wealth or value for surrounding properties. And you know, you basically come up with something that is what it's designed to serve, which is very transactional. And cities as a long-term entity don't survive from a transactional standpoint. They survive by creating wealth and productivity and a high level of prosperity.
So, you know, when you think about going back to, I almost look at the Strong Towns movement as refocusing on the things that made cities in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, you know, Is that, how do you think about that in the context of like the private versus public sector? Because, you know, a lot of what got us to the mid-century development pattern was very top-down, you know, dictated through zoning rules, through investment in highways, et cetera. So are you arguing, you know, in some ways for more of a private sector role in it?
Yeah, it's very, it's, this is really interesting. And I find like the social, political, cultural dynamics of this to be utterly fascinating. Because if you went back 100 years ago, let's say, and you looked at this dynamic of what the, you know, let's just, for lack of a better term, let's use the term free market. What the market was giving us was this evolved human habitat, this kind of cultural inheritance of here's how you build a place. And kind of the progressive pushback on that at the time was, we need to fix all the ills of this approach. We need zoning, we need building codes, we need government intervention in financing housing and financing commercial buildings. We need to start building highways and transportation infrastructure, and we need a federal program to do that. And so there were all these interventions that came about from a progressive movement standpoint that were designed to make cities better, designed to make them better places. After World War II, this became a joint political project. So in a sense, the private sector, the titans of industry, the real estate market, the developers, the banks, they all joined in with what pre-Great Depression was a progressive project, right? A progressive reform movement. And you had this period of time, this couple decades after World War II, where in a sense, everybody was on board, right? We could build new suburbs that met all of the kind of check boxes of what would be really high quality housing, building a middle class, blue collar jobs, all the like, you know, progressive stuff that people wanted pre-Great Depression, all of a sudden could be manifested in these new suburbs. All of the kind of big business, Republican-esque kind of things, let's get the bankers involved, let's get the developers involved, let's go build, let's bring in corporations and industry, and all of that became manifested in this thing as well. As time has gone on, and it has been shown to be in many ways a failure, the sensitivities to it have morphed. And what we see is that there's a lot of progressive sensitivity to the problems of this development pattern. And a lot of the more conservative instincts are now coalesced around how do we maintain it and how do we sustain it? And that is in a century, it's an absolute reversal of kind of where we were. You know, I think the challenge we have right now is that both of these impulses, let's say, are very top down and centralized and financially very high burn. When you step back and you look at this stuff from a bottom up standpoint, you see that that dissonance is actually doing a lot of harm to both sensitivities. Cities spend a ton of money. They spend it very unproductively, and they do it in a way that actually drives down quality of life. And so if you are progressively sensitive, you feel those problems, but you tend to default to a big top-down fix for it. If you're conservative, you also feel those problems. You're sensitive to it, but you again default to like, let's come in and regulate cities and tell them what they can and can't do. And somehow we need to overcome that centralizing impulse if we want to move things in a different direction. Does that make sense, Brian?
It does. I want to dig into it a little bit more, but first I want to go back to a statement you made. And, you know, be really explicit about what you mean. Because you said, you know, this suburban development pattern has been a failure. You know, what do you mean by that? Yeah. And kind of how are you arriving at that?
Well, I think it's been a failure on its own merits. But, you know, let's deal with that first. And then I think we can talk about the broader quality of life, city living kind of thing. On its own merits, the suburban development pattern was designed to keep us out of a Great Depression. We had experienced the Great Depression. We, you know, quote unquote, got out of the Great Depression because we participated in a global war that, you know, create a lot of jobs for soldiers, which are not, you know, the kind of jobs you're looking for in an economy, but it solved the GDP problem, create a lot of jobs for people who were building all the implements of war, right? The ships and the bombs and the munitions, right, and the planes and all that. Once the war was over, economists were convinced that we were just going to go right back into the Depression. And this suburban experiment was a way to take all of this capacity that we had and put it into something that ostensibly we wouldn't throw away, you know, like a plane or a bomb that you drop. But we would be able to build a middle class. We'd be able to create intergenerational wealth. We'd be able to make a better version of cities. That worked for a while. And I think if you measure the success of the suburban experiment in terms of the 1950s and the 1960s, it would be easier to say, wow, this was really successful. You have, of course, you know, what we colloquially call white flight today, the idea of wealthy people, affluent people decamping from cities and leaving behind impoverished people in places that were less cared for. Nobody calls that success, but that is certainly part of the what happened. You know, but in general, when we think about the 1950s and the 1960s economically, it was a time of tremendous recovery. It was a time of expanding middle class. You know, it was a great time. When we get beyond that, that's when everything starts to bite. When you build a new road, it lasts for 20 years and then you got to go fix it. When you put a pipe in the ground, it will last for a number of decades. We've been able to do it better now than they did in the 50s and 60s, so that window is longer. But the stuff we built in the 50s and 60s, after 20 years, 30 years, it needed to be, most of it needed to be overhauled or replaced in some way.
Right.
When you start to look at that maintenance burden, what you see is that the cost of that, the overhang of that, is many multiples of the wealth that was created. So we created a new subdivision with a bunch of new homes, and they're all taxpayers now. And you look at the tax that they would pay or the revenue capacity they had, and it was not nearly enough, 10%, 15%, 20% of what was required to provide the ongoing service and maintenance of that development pattern. It was, after one life cycle, financially insolvent. What we did in the 70s and the 80s, and then accelerated this afterwards, is we just built more of it. We started to use debt. We started to borrow money from the future in big ways. And we listened to the economists that told us infrastructure was a great investment. Let's just grow. And we can grow our way out of this insolvency. If you lose money on every transaction, you don't make it up on volume. And the American post-war development pattern has been one big Ponzi scheme. And we are now living in a situation where we have vastly more liabilities than we have capacity to sustain them. And so on its own merits, like, we're gonna leave this traditional development pattern, and we're going to solve the problems by creating an economy that grows very, very quickly. On that basis alone, this has been an absolute failure. We have created a system that has robbed us of our potential to grow productively and experience the fruits of that growth as prosperity.
So one thing I love about the Strong Towns mindset is, you know, there's a few pillars to it. You know, there's one pillar, there's one lens you could look at it through, which is kind of the trad lens. You know, you're looking at 19th century, 20th century, early American cities and saying, return. That is a better way of living.
Sure.
You know, culturally, aesthetically, et cetera. But there's another pillar of it, which is very financial. It's very focused on the fiscal health of American cities and the unsustainability of a suburban approach. I mean, I went to high school in a mid-sized southern city, and you're driving around the suburbs of this city, and you can see the suburbs of each decade, and the ones that were built in the 60s are kind of like decrepit and old, and the 70s they're starting to get there, and like every decade they go and build, you know, plow up some new land and build a new chunk of suburbs, and that's where everyone wants to move. It struck me in high school as a patently unsustainable approach from just an economic standpoint. Yeah. And so one thing that,
that's what we see. Yeah. Go on. No, no, keep going. So I'm interested in your question.
Yeah, I did want to tackle, you know, this question of the path out to a more sustainable form of development. So I'll give my own example as a, you know, as someone who's done real estate. You talk about centralization versus decentralization and arguing for a decentralized approach. But when I see decentralized approaches, when I think about that as a real estate guy, I think local community board meetings. And nothing is more NIMBY, yeah, anti-development, no, anti-anything totally. than a local community board meeting. Whereas like the centralized approaches, think about the state of California passing pro-housing reforms, seem to be more oriented to moving toward a different kind of model. So how do you think about the role of centralization there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Let me do a little bit of nuance, and then let me answer that directly. There is this kind of traditional sense that comes out of strong towns, but it's not a let's return to the early 19th century. There are people who nostalgize that, and we're not part of that group. We look at where we're at today as a huge challenge. And what we recognize is why we moved away from something that, you know, that we thought we could do better. And we also recognize that there's a lot we can learn from the way that things were done before that are applicable to where we're at now. But we can't go back. I mean, we are where we are, right? So how do we move ahead? I have this tension because I look at what the state of California has done as an example. I think it's a good example because California is often a preview of coming attractions for everyone else. California has made its cities implementation arms of state policy. So a city is not, in a strong towns framework, what is a city? What is a local government? A local government is the highest form of collaboration for people living together in a community. It's the way we work together. We work together on our block. We work together in our neighborhoods. And when things are too big for us to do at the block level, at the neighborhood level, we've got a city as like a coordinating unit that can help us work together here to get things done. If you are in Sacramento, if you are in St. Paul here in my state of Minnesota, what a city is it's the implementation arm of state policy. So it's not like a coordinating unit for local people. What it is like, we want something to happen, so we're going to tell cities, this is what you have to do. And I'm not even talking as much as like mandates. I know that, you know, Republicans get all uptight about government mandates. What I'm talking about is like, we want to create growth. So here's a program to build sewer pipes everywhere. Apply for this program. Here's a program in my state right now. We have this obsession over children's museums. We think children's museums are great. And so we're going around trying to convince every city to build a children's museum, and we're giving them like 3/4 of the money to do it. This has made every city obsess over children's museums now. Suddenly this thing that we never thought about becomes the thing we covet the most, right? So when we look at cities and their role today, it's largely as implementation arm of state and federal policy. In that rubric, local control is absurd because local control is just a reinforcing of past patterns. It doesn't really move the needle at all. And in fact, it becomes almost like the worst reactionary form of itself. The NIMBY reaction, as you know, stated it, is not a helpful approach. But when we have cities that orient themselves horizontally instead of vertically around what the state and federal government wants, what outside developers will bring in, what Wall Street capital we can get, but they start to orient themselves horizontally around what's going on in their neighborhoods, where people struggle, what are the things we can do with what we have on hand, What we see is that they become beautiful places almost instantly. They become places that solve lots of problems very, very quickly for people. They become places that, instead of squandering seven figures of resources, they deploy five figures of resources in ways that really benefit people very quickly. And so I struggle because I have acquiesced to the idea that state governments that get this can be a catalyst for, in a sense, reorienting local governments. But the objectives are not the same, right? Like the state of California saying to cities, you have to allow backyard cottages and granny flats, is the state of California pursuing their goals. It's not the state of California, in a sense, nudging the city to step up and kind of take control of their own place. And what we advocate for at Strong Towns is cities recognizing that they can solve a lot of their own problems if they get off this treadmill that is keeping them stuck and actually focus on, you know, building a prosperous, financially successful Strong Town. That interplay between the role of the state and the role of the local, I think, is a tricky one to thread.
You know, just maybe to build on that and talk about California for a second. I mean, one of the challenges I've seen, I'm interested in your take on this, is, you know, a place like San Francisco, the Bay Area, you know, it is economically kind of a coherent thing, but it's split into, I don't know, 100 different cities that each kind of have their own domain, some of which are larger than others. So it's very tough for those cities to coordinate to solve metro level issues. And in some cases, they're not really even cities. They're just kind of neighborhoods with, you know, some additional powers.
Right.
You know, what's your take on kind of the right size of the jurisdictional unit in a place like the San Francisco Bay Area, where, you know, you have 6 million people, 7 million people in one economic unit with a bunch of different jurisdictions within there? Should it be smaller or should it be bigger?
It's a good question. And I'm going to tell you that I don't know the answer. I don't really have the answer to that question. I will say,
I'm not sure it's answerable.
There's a principle. It's maybe not, right? There's a principle called subsidiarity that I feel like applies here really, really well. If you're going to do a regional transit system, which San Francisco has BART, right? I mean, they do have a regional transit system. If you're going to do that, you can't do that by aggregating a bunch of individual decision makers together. You have to have a regional entity to do that, and it has to be a cooperative regional entity. If you are going to maintain sidewalks, if you try to do that regionally, you're going to fail. Like you don't have the sensitivity, the flexibility, the adaptability to be able to do that regionally. You will mess up the finances of it. You will rob Peter here to pay Paul over there. You'll do all kinds of things that make no sense. And your sensitivities are just not wired to work in that way. So when we look at something like maintaining sidewalks or, you know, approving housing or building a corner library, you know, there's all these things that are very neighborhood level focused. We need to find a way to have the feedback loops between what we do, how we pay for it, what our priorities are, be as localized as possible. A lot of reasons why you get the NIMBY situation in a place like San Francisco be so pronounced and so ingrained is that, you know, we have this 6 million person regional entity that is maintaining the sidewalks in front of our place. So there's a huge disconnect between the wealth being created and the value being created. And really, let's break it down even further. The number of housing units on our street and our overall capacity, right? There's a breakdown between that and having my sidewalk maintained. If we go back to the traditional development pattern, if we go back to pre-Great Depression, every street wanted to add more people. Like, let's build that backyard cottage. Let's make that single family home into a duplex. Let's continue to add people, because the more people we add, the more capacity we have. And when we have more capacity, we can maintain that sidewalk. We can make the road nice. We can have a library. We can have a fire department. We can, you know, do all these things. In a big system like San Francisco, there's a disconnect between my contribution and my block's contribution to the whole and the services that we expect to be delivered. And that breakdown allows NIMBYism to flourish, because, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the kind of negative aspects of growth in this post-war development pattern. You have to only look at traffic and parking to recognize that in this pattern, the way we build, you get every increment, you get way more traffic, you get way more congestion, you get way more demand for parking. And if you're in San Francisco, it's very, very easy for you to conclude growth is bad. I don't want to see any more of it. I'm anti-growth, but give me all my services and deliver it to me. And that disconnect reinforces, you know, the fiction that we have that we can do this all without growing, without thickening up.
Right. Right. So you get the degrowth mindset, and to each individual actor, it makes sense.
I mean, to each individual actor, it makes sense. And the development pattern actually atomizes us and creates conflict among us, as opposed to requiring us to harmonize things. And I keep using that phrase, harmonize things. If you think of your own life, like think of your own family, think of your own household, right? You have to harmonize competing interests all the time. What are we going to spend money on? What are we going to do today? Who's going to, I'm in Minnesota, who's going to shovel the snow on the sidewalks? Who's going to, you know, we have these things that we work out. My neighbor, I really, really adore. And if I don't get up early enough and get out there, they will shovel my sidewalks for me. I try to get out ahead of them and get their sidewalks shoveled. We're competitive in a way that is kind to each other, right?
That is so Minnesota. It's like the most Minnesota thing.
It is very Minnesota. But you know, you work out these things, right? Like you work them out. If we just had an entity that shoveled our sidewalks for us, you know, the regional government shoveled our sidewalks for us, and we didn't have to do that, our role then would not be to work together and talk about this and come up with a solution. Our role would be to bitch and complain about the inadequacy of the centralized government in solving this problem for me. You know, it is a different version of what government is.
So we've talked about the theory, the concepts. A lot of our listeners here at Thesis Driven are in real estate. I want to talk about the practice. So, you know, in our newsletter, we've interviewed a number of developers kind of implementing a new urbanist approach, practices. You know, just a couple months ago, we profiled Casey Roloff, who built Seabrook, Washington, very, informed by Seaside, by new urbanist principles. What's your take on all that? I mean, on one hand, they're building the right typology. On the other hand, that is somewhat top down.
Yeah. So I'm I can't remember what I'm called, honorary fellow. I was adopted into the CNU group of people they want to honor and people who are influential in the movement. And
CNU being the Congress of New Urbanism.
That was the Congress for the New Urbanism. Yeah. That was a huge honor for me, because in the early 2000s, as I was starting my own engineering planning firm, I ran into these questions of like, okay, this doesn't work. As an engineer, I was charged with building it. I knew it didn't work then, but I figured it's like other people knew stuff. Then I did the planning, and the planning was like, oh my gosh, this really doesn't work. Like it wasn't like I was missing knowledge. It's like the knowledge wasn't there. And I went searching for something that did work. Like there's gotta be people doing this better. And I kept coming back to the new urbanism. Like I would look for an answer and the new urbanist had come up with it. And I'd be like, oh, darn, I'm not an urbanist. I'm not a new urbanist. This is not me. And then I would like run into another problem and I would look for the answer, and god dang, those new urbanists had figured this one out too. And I wound up going to a Congress for the New Urbanism, their annual gathering. And I was just blown away by not only the breadth of knowledge they have about the built environment, but how it is not, and it certainly wasn't back then, a politically driven organization, but it was really a bottom-up organization about how do we get things done? How do we actually go out and build great places? I feel like what the New Urbanists have done is they have resurrected past knowledge and then applied it to today. That applied it to today gives it a little bit of dissonance sometimes with strong towns, with our approach, because it does, you know, to apply things today means you build in large blocks and you build to a finished state. So you would access millions of dollars of capital to build something in a big way all at once. And when you built it, it would be done, you know, world without end. Like, this is the way it will be forever. And you can look at Seaside as like the original New Urbanist development. I think the fascinating thing about Seaside is that Andres and Liz are geniuses. They did plan on this thing evolving over time. If you go up the road from Seaside to Alice Beach, you're looking at a place that is built using, you know, 8 figures, 9 figures, 10 figures of capital. Right. And it's built to be permanent, to like never evolve and change. And I do think that that is the biggest challenge that New Urbanism has today. It's a better version of suburban development. It takes the standard suburban model and builds in a way that is financially more productive, is more desired in a marketplace, creates environments that actually I think are more human friendly. But they likewise have not solved the problem of how do we evolve and maintain things over time. The theory seems to be if we build a place worth maintaining, people will maintain it. And, you know, you could go to Detroit today and see that that theory does not universally hold. I mean, Detroit is full of gorgeous buildings that were worth maintaining that nobody maintained. So I'm a little bit skeptical on that part of it. But if you want to see beautiful cities, if you want to see great urban design, the New Urbanist stuff is the best that there is in North America today. It really is.
Yeah, I think that's well said, because they haven't changed. They're building something better, but they're not changing the underlying framework of how it gets built. It is still the model of assemble a bunch of capital, go build something, as opposed to,
right,
say, create a new framework and an environment for development, which, as I'm thinking about that, perhaps the... You may disagree with this. The best example of a strong towns approach taken today in the United States is about 60 miles north of New York City. It is the town of Kiryas Joel, which is built by the Satmar Hasidic community. You've been there. I love it. I toured there about a year and a half ago. It's an extraordinary place. Interested in your take on it, but
horrible urban design.
It's all Ford Windstar minivans. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
But so it is, in some ways, they control their own zoning, and it is, you know, yes, a bunch of independent developers each kind of doing their own thing, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I'm curious your take on why you think the design is bad.
I got mixed up with the Hasidic in a good way. Back in the mid 2000s, it's very funny because there was a group in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, that wanted to build a city for 20,000 Hasidic Jews in rural Kansas. And this is way before Strong Down. So I was not known beyond central Minnesota in any way. And they did an internet search and came up with a, you know, small town planner, me, and they called me and said, would you help us build this city? And I'm like, I'm totally unqualified for this. Of course I will. And I went out and met them and got to spend time in an environment. I mean, people listening might not know this. I live in the city of Brainerd, Minnesota. This is 14,000 people in the center of Minnesota. I was brought up on a farm. I, you know, I am the furthest thing from a community of Hasidic Jews that you could possibly be. This was a fascinating cultural exchange to get to know some really remarkable people and understand their vision. We ultimately didn't do it, but as part of that experience, I got to tour Curious Joel. If we listed the positives of Curious Joel, I would say you mentioned them, the idea that it's a bunch of different people building a bunch of different things, and you could see how in an evolutionary process, they can fix the mistakes that they've made over time, right? They can continue to grow and they continue to turn things around. I think from a challenging standpoint, Curious Joel is, I'm going to say this, understanding that I have a huge amount of reverence for what they are trying to do culturally. I'm Catholic and I'm kind of blown away by how secular like practicing Catholicism is at times, you know, how transactional it is. My church is right there. And the thing we've done in the last 5 years of my church is build two big parking lots by tearing down the neighborhood. In Curious Joel, the idea is that, and this was their phrase, once a week we go Amish. So once a week they have their Sabbath, they take it very seriously. Right. They do not drive. They do not use any machinery, any electronics. They walk to their synagogues and their temples and their places of worship. Yeah. And they have their meetings and their prayers and ultimately culminating in their meals. I found it very beautiful and a very inspiring kind of way to live in a community. But they didn't design it around that. They designed it around the other 6 days of the week, which, you know, big automobile infrastructure, large investments in you know, weird big cul-de-sacs, buildings that didn't frame the public realm very well, but actually kind of turned their back to it in a way that I think could be fixed over time, but gave the impression of a kind of an anti-social space. And so it was fascinating to me how the culture of the community transcended the negativity of the building design. I was really fascinated as we were talking about this project in Kansas, what it would be like to have really good urban design and then put in a close-knit community into a place that was well designed for them. What if you didn't have, and I brought this up, I'm like, what if you didn't have to drive everywhere? What if you, you know, the experience you had on Saturday of walking to the synagogue, what if you Monday through, you know, the rest of the week, walk to the store and walk to the restaurant and walk to the park and walk to meet your friends and walk to your job and walk to other things? What if that was the way you did it? And they just could not, like, I don't understand. Like, how could that be? And I'm like, well, you're building a place in the middle of Kansas. Like, what, you know, you're in the middle of Brooklyn. Like, what do you want to, I mean, what do you want to do? You're in like the most walkable right. place in North America. Like, why do you all own cars? You're actually kind of poor. Like, why would you burden yourself with that? And like culturally, they were very stuck on it. And I just accepted it because it was what they brought to the table.
Fascinating. I'm glad we covered that. I do want to hear from you. I mean, I kind of threw out Curious Joel, not even knowing you had direct experience with it. I think you're the first person I've thrown that out to who's actually been there. But you know, where do you think is doing it well? I mean, if you were to pick a city or place that you think is embodying the Strong Towns approach in the best way possible, you know, what would you name?
People ask me this all the time, and I have cities that will say, hey, we have a touring program where we get to take elected leaders and other community leaders and bring them and show them great stuff. Where would we go? Should we go to Amsterdam or Paris? And I'm like, no, go to Detroit, go to Memphis, go to Buffalo, go to Shreveport. These are places that I've been in where I've seen some of the most innovative things in North America. These are the places of the greatest level of innovation, and it's the greatest level of innovation and kind of retrofitting and making use of space that I've seen, because they are very poor. The fact that they're poor makes them very entrepreneurial. So, you know, other places will have investors who call themselves entrepreneurs, but entrepreneurs are really people who make something out of nothing. I mean, they're people with a vision who figure out how to like bring it about, even with a lack of resources. Memphis is like the epicenter of human capital in North America. I mean, you have some of the poorest people in the country, but you also have these pockets of people just doing ridiculously inspiring things with places. Taking rundown blocks and with a little bit of paint and a little bit of elbow grease, fixing them up and making them really beautiful and making them really work. And when we go out and measure it financially, what we see is that you take neighborhoods and you increase their value, their worth by, you know, 10 times, 20 times with just tiny, tiny investments and a little bit of like human love for them. It really is astounding what they're doing in these places. And I think, you know, for someone who lives in like a very affluent suburb where the grass is mowed and the streets are new and your TJ Maxx sits next to your Arby's and it's all very clean and like antiseptic, if you went to Memphis, you would find it disorienting because it's not clean and antiseptic, right? It is messy and chaotic. But if you walk around there with a strong town's eye, you will see places that in other communities are barren and lacking in vitality. And you will see in Memphis all the hallmarks of a place on the rise. Whether it is just the fact that you're going to see humans out in the place doing things, all the way to seeing a lot of like art being put on, you know, places where you don't normally see it. These are amazing neighborhoods that I think we can learn a lot from. Because, Brad, I know you. A lot of the people here are going to be real estate people. Let me draw a distinction between real estate people. I think there's people who go out and build new stuff in new places, and there is a model for them to do that, and that is the post-war model, and it is one that is. Got a lot of capital thrown at it. It's the one that our zoning codes and our building codes are set up to deal with. It is that model. There's another model of going out and taking existing neighborhoods and making them more productive, more financially successful, better right. places to live. That is the model that I think we are moving towards. That's the model that our cities need to adopt and figure out how to work with. And the places that are pioneering that model are the Detroits, are the Memphis, Buffalo, Shreveport, those kind of places, because that's been the only type. They don't really have a lot of the first kind of developer. They have had to create the second because it's been imperative to making their places work.
Yeah. And you do have, I mean, a lot of infill developers here learning, understanding, thinking about places that yes. they're going to go, neighborhoods they can go into. You know, we've done a lot of features on historic tax credit redevelopment. It's one of the few types of development that's actually still penciling out today, given where rates are, given the state yeah. of the state of the environment. So trying to encourage people to get into that as much as we can.
Yeah, you know, but what a pain in the neck, you know? I mean, I was just going to say, I wish we could find a way to... I think a big part of what needs to happen is that the finance of this stuff needs to also become more localized. If you go back to the early 1900s, there was nobody building anything at the local level without a local bank and local financing and right. local backing. And try to do that today. I mean, every local bank, if they create a transaction with you, is, you know, looking to unload that onto a secondary market. And correct. So if your product, if the thing you want to do does not check boxes in a way where it can become synonymous with the same thing someone else is doing in another community and be packaged into a security of like-minded products. In other words, if you're trying to do anything innovative, that market does not work well for you. And I think we need to get our local banks actually more localized and doing these kind of custom specialty things that will allow our developers to add, create a lot of value for people. I mean, it's got to be frustrating for people building, in a sense, the same custom home over and over again, or the same custom product over and over again, because it can be securitized. You know, it's a dumbing down of our system, really.
Well, one of the ironies of the past 18 months is that, you know, lenders, banks, traditional construction lenders have almost entirely withdrawn from the market through a combination of interest rate pressure, regulatory pressure, their existing loan books aren't getting paid back. And so they've been replaced in a form by these debt funds. And there's a whole plethora of different types of debt funds out there. But in most cases, they're smaller and focused on a more local area. So in some sense, we've gone back to a more local model of lending just because the banks have entirely exited the construction lending market. Probably not how anyone drew it up, but that's the state of the market is doing some funny things.
Well, and it's I think the odd part about it is the system we have created today has been designed to reduce volatility. Like that's its, you know, the Federal Reserve itself was established because we had all this volatility, and the idea was that we would have this system that reduced the overall volatility and therefore drove up market efficiencies and allowed people to make longer term bets, and we'd have more liquidity and we'd have more investment, we'd have higher prosperity. And I, all of it rests on this idea that you would have reduced volatility. You would not have, you know, banking would be regulated and in such a way that capital could be efficiently deployed. And what we see now is that the shadow market, if we want to call it that, or the non-regulated market is now so much substantially bigger than the rest of it, that this question of volatility, I think, is questionable. And yeah, in real estate, you see it manifest in ways that you don't see it manifest in other parts of the market, or at least not that I'm able to understand, but I do see it in real estate all the time. And it is odd. It's, I'll say this, and your audience might not appreciate this. Maybe they will. It feels like one step above, you know, I'm going to break your knees kind of lending, right? Like it is, you know, we're almost to loan sharking.
People are doing hard money loans too.
Yeah. And sorry, so, you know, I struggle with it because to me, it is a huge, if you are a macroeconomist, you're likely very divorced from this. But if you understand macroeconomics in a tiny degree, but you work in the real world, you see that these models and these theories that people use to set interest rate policy and what have you are completely divorced from reality. I mean, a decade of 0% interest rates is basically like just removing all gravity from the market, and you get things floating around and distorting in ways that nobody's ever seen before. Now we jack interest rates back up. Ostensibly, they're going to go back down again, but you have this like very weird shakeup where, like, I don't know if anybody really knows how to make good real estate investments today. I mean, it's really, we're supposed to decrease volatility. And I think what we've actually done is had a false decrease in macro volatility while we have increased risk and tension at the local level. Manyfold.
Interesting. Yeah. Certainly take some time for it to shake out and deals to pencil again.
It will. Yeah.
One last question before we move to the lightning round and the quick questions. 15-minute city conspiracy theories. You know, this 15-minute city concept borrows a lot, you know, from Strongtown's philosophy, shares a lot with it. Now that you see governments embracing it, it's generating a lot of negative reactions, a lot of conspiracy theories. I mean, what's your take on the reaction to that? Is that a kind of reaction against a centralized approach?
Yeah. And I think it's no more complicated than that. And let me go a step further and say, I don't think that aspect of it is unjustified, right? I mean, I did a whole podcast on this, and I had a lot of people thank me for it. And then I had a lot of people very angry with me. The people that were angry with me tended to be people who have a centralizing mentality. And a lot of the, I mean, let's state this openly, a lot of the people who talk about 15-minute cities talk about it through the lens of climate change, centralized government, centralized approaches. This is what we're going to deliver to you from the top down. And, while they may find a lot of things, a lot of those people tend to like Strongtown's critique of the suburbs, but they tend to be a little bit reticent when it comes to actually having bottom-up action and bottom-up actors shape the direction of their community. They'll say, we want public engagement. We want lots of people talking, but we want them talking about these five things that we want to see happen from the top down. I think there is a tension with the 15-minute cities, and it really is on where the sensitivities are and where the direction and the guidance come from. If you're going to have Google come in and build your city for you, and it's going to be this great electronic city, or if you're going to have, the federal government come in and mandate that you do A, B, and C because that's a 15-minute cities approach, I think you're going to get a lot of pushback. And I think even if it was successful culturally, I think you're not going to like the outcome. I think these are not going to be livable places. To use their language, it's not going to be a sustainable place ultimately. I think the way you get to sustainable and the way you get to livable and the way you get to financially productive and the way you get to cultural buy-in is you actually have shorter feedback loops within a block level in a community. And when you do that, what we see is that there's a massive, massive market preference for walkable neighborhoods, with corner stores and narrow streets and slow traffic and people able to gather and congregate and have their own private space, but also have a lot of shared public space that is very high quality. These look a lot like the layouts and the plans for 15-minute cities. When we have a locally based market, we tend to get really good outcomes. And I say good outcomes that people desire, but outcomes that also, from a financial standpoint, work out really well. But from an environmental standpoint, from a social cultural standpoint, from a public health standpoint, also tend to work out really well. Guess what? That's what harmonizing means, right? That when I say humans harmonize over thousands of years, they built places that made them really human. And when we build places that make us really human, humans tend to thrive in them. When we make places that require us to drive 45 minutes one way each day, we become fat and lazy and crabby. We become antisocial. We become lonely. We become depressed. We become suicidal. There's a whole lot of things that come out of that progressives tend to be very sensitive to, as I said before. That doesn't make those sensitivities wrong. But when the reaction is we need a big top-down program to solve this stuff, and it comes through as 15-minute cities, the conspiracy theorists, the anti-vax people, the people who resist other like centralized approaches get their hackles up. And I understand that reaction. I just think that we need to localize stuff. And then I think a lot of this tension dissolves because we all kind of want the same thing in our own neighborhoods, really.
Let's move the lightning round. So these are a few questions, quick answers, and then we'll wrap up. So first question, tell us about one startup, developer, or entrepreneur you're watching and why.
Oh, that's really interesting. You said quick, and I'm like, I don't know as I am watching anything specific. I mean, I'm fascinated with the AI stuff, and I'm not fascinated with it, I think, from the way most people are. we do a lot of communications here at Strong Towns, and this is a device that I think can magnify communications efforts. And so as an organization, we've always tried to be like two steps ahead of everybody else who's communicating in our space. And I've just been watching like the startup ecosystem of people bringing AI to bear in a communication space, because I want to learn from it and I don't want to be behind it. That's not really real estate-y, and I'm sorry, but I tend to not be maybe plugged in that way.
What's one city or place you'd bet on?
I would bet today on Memphis. I mean, Memphis is, I love the city so much. And you have social capital pours from the ground like oil in Texas in the early 1900s. You just put a tap in and like social capital comes up. This is a place that I think 50 years from now will be one of America's great cities.
If you could change one specific real estate related law or policy, what would it be?
Just by fiat.
By fiat.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the easiest one is I would eliminate all parking minimums, all parking requirements everywhere across the entire continent. I mean, I just do it by fiat. I feel like that's an easy out because, you know, 10 years ago, very few places had done it. Today, there's hundreds that have done it. So I feel like we're winning that battle. We've been pushing on that one a long time. The one that is is in the early stages that's starting to gain momentum is the restriction on single family zoning, the exclusive single family zoning category. I would love to see that lifted, and I'd love to see every lot be able to build at least 2 units or 3 units on it by fiat. There's no reason for us to have exclusive single family zoning.
Agreed. Last question. What's your favorite app on your home screen?
I have been using Notion a lot. Notion is a very like weird wiki database, communications, like all in one tool. And we started using it earlier this year, and I've been doing a lot of baking for Christmas and tracking my Christmas presents that I'm buying people. And I find myself using Notion for work and now using Notion for home. And it's like Notion has taken over my life. So that would probably be it for me. Either that or Audible, because I'm a huge audiobook listener and I just do that as much as I can.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining the Thesis Driven podcast this morning. Really, really excited to and happy to have had you on. You know, you're one of the real original thinkers in urbanism and in built world policy. Someone really on your own path, and the author of not just Strong Towns. Really encourage my audience to check this out if they're excited about this, and Confessions of a Recovering Engineer, your most recent book. Chuck, thank you so much for having us, for being on today. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation today with Charles Marone, talking about a lot of topics at the intersection of cities, innovation, policy, things that we've come to talk about, think a lot about across the 12 episodes of season one of the Thesis Driven Leader series. Well, that was our final episode of season one. So I really want to thank everyone for listening in, for joining into these conversations, and being a part of this first season of the Thesis Driven podcast and video series. Please keep tabs on what we're doing. We have a newsletter on Substack, that's thesisdriven.com, and you'll find out all about everything we're doing, both the written newsletter content as well as future podcast episodes and seasons. So once again, thank you all so much, and see you very soon.